Hi, and welcome to the River Talk Podcast, a podcast about whitewater rafting, kayaking, and stuff. It's a podcast I do with Eric Weiseth and Priscilla Macy. They're both busy this week, and so I have my friend Aaron Cavagnolo on the show. Welcome again to the show, Aaron.
Thanks. Happy to be back.
Yeah, you're becoming a co-host, so thank you for being part of the show on a regular basis. It's been fun talking about this stuff with you. And let's just jump right into news of the week. I don't know if you heard about this one, Aaron, but we've been had this bill in Oregon that boaters, recreational boaters with boats longer than 10 feet have to get an aquatic invasive species permit that's $5. But now it's going to be $17 and include a fund for more boater access. So basically to paddle and to raft here in Oregon, you have to have a $17 annual permit. And that just passed the legislature. It's going to the governor. What do you think about that, Aaron? Do we have to pay to be a boater?
Well, so is this just for private boaters or is it for commercial craft as well now?
It's for commercial craft as well. We have a separate fee structure, but it's mainly for private boaters.
Wow. Over 10 feet long, huh?
Yeah, so kayaks are good. So it's very specific 10 feet, right? Because most kayaks are 9 feet. And so we're talking.
Yeah, those. Sell your green boat now.
Yeah. Don't buy any kayaks over 10 feet. So this applies to like long inflatable kayaks, pretty much all rafts, sea kayaks, paddle boards. You have to have a $17 annual permit. I don't know. I'm kind of torn on this because I like the access. Like the money's supposed to go into a fund that's supposed to be used for access, and hopefully it is. You know, like put-ins and takeouts. But it just feels to me un-American to pay money to go boating.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, and I feel like that's gonna decrease people's travel into the state to go paddle. You know, yeah. It's like it's a pain. Just like it's just a hindrance. It's like we got to get that too and take care of that. Just like, well, let's just go here then instead. Like instead of going over the border into Oregon, let's just go paddle this in California.
Yeah.
So I mean, more funding seems like a good thing to me too. But $17 a year for a boat's pretty reasonable. I mean, that's not that much. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So it's $17 per boater. The permit's transferable. So if you have multiple boats, you just have to have the permit with you, and you can use it on different boats. And there's a 2-year $30 deal that kind of helps. So it's certainly annoying, and I think un-American, but it's not the worst thing that can happen. And go ahead, Aaron.
What about motorboats?
So motorboats have always paid these fees. That's where the issue comes up. In Oregon, to have a motorboat, you have to have these licenses, and they've always paid it. So the motorized users have been subsidizing non-motorized users, and so they're annoyed that we're using the ramps, but they're the ones paying for it. So this is the idea here is to make sure that everybody is paying for river and lake access.
And sailboaters have to pay it too?
I don't know, probably. Most sailboats have motors, so they probably have to. So if they didn't before, they do now because it's, you know, this is for non-motorized. It's specifically for non-motorized.
Watercraft,
yeah. I mean, I feel bad for people in Boise that paddle the Owyhee River because, you know, it's 2 hours from Boise to the Owyhee, and if they want to come into Oregon to paddle, they got to get this tag. They probably won't have no effect on the Owyhee, right? Like, the Owyhee's so far from the rest of Oregon.
I think, in my mind, the biggest problem is if it's going to be easy to get the tag, can you just go online and pay and print one off or get one on your phone and like, hey, I've got my tag on my phone right here, then I don't think it's a big deal. But if it's a pain in the ass to get, that's where it becomes a problem because then it's going to impact people going there. Yeah. So they need to make access to the permits and ability to get the permits really easy.
Yeah. I think they are, but I don't know. It just doesn't feel right. I feel like I should be able to freely go boating. This is, you know, it's a free country. I shouldn't have to get permits and passes for everywhere I want to park. You know, right by the time you go boating in some place, you have to pay to park and or pay for a shuttle and pay for this permit and this license. And it's getting expensive to go recreate.
Well, so you're saying if I, like, have my own piece of property, with my own lake on it, theoretically, I'm supposed to pay the fee to go paddle my boat on my little lake?
I don't know. I don't know much about it, but I would assume not. Because if it's on your property, well, they're not going to enforce it on your property. Right? They're not going to, like...
Yeah. I mean, they're already charging us. I feel like you're already getting charged to do put-ins and takeouts, and if you're going to go run the Rogue or go run these sections of river, you got to pay for your permits anyways.
Yeah. So there is an exemption for federally managed wild and scenic rivers. So you don't... Actually, I mentioned the Oahe earlier. You probably don't need this for the Oahe, actually, because there's an exemption for that. And you won't need it for the Rogue. So rivers like that where you're already getting a permit to run the river and it's a federally managed wild and scenic, you won't need to get this for those rivers. This is more for the other rivers.
So if we hike in and do Rapid Creek again or whatever that was, Rapid River, we're supposed to have the fee because they provide all sorts of access for us on that run?
It's not because they provided access. It's because they want to collect money to provide future access. So it has nothing to do with where you're going. It's the promise that they're going to fund future access issues. You know, here in Hood River where I live, on the Hood, the access is awful. Like, we're lowering rafts down cliffs all the time, and it's just really hard. I would love to see better access, but I don't think that's going to happen here in Hood River. This is going to happen at more popular boating destinations.
It seems to make – the more you talk about it, the more it makes sense to me, I'll say. Because, like, hey, if your boat's under 10 feet, you really don't need to access, right? You've got a kayak. You can carry it in anywhere. And, like, we don't need to access. And you're not paying for it for those boats. Mm-hmm. So I guess that makes sense to me. And if you got a big old raft, if you've got a 14-foot raft, yeah, you're going to want some access. And that's – I think that's good for – that's good overall for the economy and for people wanting to come to Oregon to boat, making access better. More people will use it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, overall, $17. Yeah, we can afford that.
Okay, cool. I mean, what about the family of five? The mom and dad and three kids that want to go paddling?
Well, it's not per person. It's for the raft, right? It's per boat.
I think it's per... I should know more about this. I think... What if they're on 10, all on their own 10-foot stand-up paddle boards? Do they need to get five of these $17 passes to go paddle for the day?
Yeah, then that sucks. Then obviously get 9-foot to paddle boards for those fat.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my news of the week. Aaron, do you have any big news of the week?
No big news. I mean, I'll just say I've been down to California. High water has been fantastic. It's great to have these big snowpacks.
Yeah.
So it's about...
I mean, high water is fun if you're solid, but if you're not, it's... I mean, is there, you know... Flipping and having long swims is not fun either.
Definitely not. And so if you're not properly prepared, wait until the water will drop. And that's that's a nice thing. And then there's easier runs you can do. Yeah. So like the East Fork of the Carson, for example, that's running for a lot longer than it normally does.
Yeah, I heard so it's gonna run into July.
Oh really? Wow.
That's what I heard. It'd be pretty amazing to do that run in July.
Yeah, that would be incredible.
Well, cool. Let's move on to news of the week. Aaron, there was a comment on our website, mailbag, with where we get emails, and we have a website with a comment section at the bottom, and somebody left a comment. Aaron kind of directed it to you, so I'm going to read it and see if you want to respond to it. This is from Aaron Babcock. As a creature crafter and rafter, I would love to run some high water with Aaron and his raft and myself and a creature. Maybe to make it easy for Aaron, let's say the Illinois is at 8,000 to 10,000. We could have a competitive run where we could both call out eddies and catch and see who can actually catch them. If he's up for the challenge, let me know. I think it would be super fun. So, Aaron, I'm all about this. I love to see you guys compete. And it sounds super fun to me. What do you think? Are you in?
I think he kind of misunderstood my comments. Like, I never said that a raft is as good for running really high water on the Illinois River. Far from it. Like, why would I want to do that? The whole point is, like, it's easier to run it in the creature craft. Uh-huh. So I was a little confused by his comments. I think he had another comment too about like being in shape. And I think that's great that Aaron's a really in shape creature crafter. My point was that you don't have to be in shape to row a creature craft. That was more my comment before. It's like, you know, like you don't have to be, you can be. It's like certain people, you don't have to be in shape to play video games either, but some people are really fit who play video games. I mean, so I think Aaron's probably way more fit than I am. And Aaron's a great boater too. You don't have to be a great boater to use a creature craft. That doesn't mean you aren't a great boater because you're using a creature craft. And I think those are those are things that those are maybe clarifications I need to make. So, but I do think, you know, the creature craft's kind of like the training wheels in a way, is you can just kind of go down and not know what you're doing and be fine. And so, and yeah, they run some huge stuff in them that I would not want to run in a raft. I think a fair competition with Aaron, if you want to have some sort of competition, is for us to both take creature crafts on a run, and then let's both take rafts on another run and see how we both do.
Oh, yeah, that seems more challenge.
Yeah, if you really want the challenge, that seems more appropriate, because I'm not going to fall on down the Illinois at whatever 10,000 CFS, you know, in a raft. That's just dumb. That's a dumb idea. But if we're talking about skills, I mean, I'm not trying to say he has bad skills, first of all. But it would be fun to fall him down. It would be fun to, like, yeah, try to catch this eddy. That would be great. I'd be up for that challenge. But then I'd be like, all right, let's do it in a raft, too. See how you do with the raft. Or, fine, if you're saying this creature craft is so great, let's not just use creature crafts on high water. Come on out with me on the Tuolumne at 600 CFS, and I'll take a raft, and you take your creature craft, and let's see how it goes.
I think there's runs if you're picking and choosing. We could pick some runs where, or some flows where a raft would do really well, and a creature craft would be stuck in a sieve three rapids back.
Exactly. You know, or let's go do a 6-day middle fork trip, and he can do it out of his creature craft, and I'll do it out of a 14-foot raft. He'd be more comfortable. You know, like, there's, you know, it's just like, there's places where creature crafts are ideal, for sure. High volume. But it's very specialized, in my point. Okay. Yeah. Hopefully he's not too offended by these comments, but yeah, that's not my intent. I think creature crafts are really neat, and I'd love to go out and paddle one. And it seems like an opportunity to see some canyons at flows and see some canyons that you wouldn't normally be able to see, which is, that's what we're about, right? Going around rivers and exploring them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like Aaron took me out, and he had an extra creature craft, took me out, and I got to see the North Fork of the Smith at high water, which is pretty cool. But I feel like it's another, like, tool in the toolbox, you know, like, if I want to go run creeks, I'll bring a kayak. If I want to go run regular rivers, I'll take whatever. But if it's a high volume, you know, big river, like, I would want a creature craft. It's a great tool for that exact job. And so I get that.
And then my last point of it was just because you can take a creature craft down something that's gnarly doesn't mean you're a good boater. You know, like, 9 times out of 10, the log makes it down the river. So don't get so excited about yourself because you did that. It's like, that doesn't, you know, and that's like, you watch a lot of these videos of these guys getting, like, not even pointing the nose at the wave and just kind of get knocked sideways, and they're on their side trying to get a breath for a while, and then they get the boat upright, and they get knocked over again, and then they get it upright. It's like, yeah, you ran it, sort of, but, I mean, it's kind of like the back in those days when the Chinese guys were trying to run the Yangtze, and they just push their buddies off in these things and pick them up at the bottom of the rapid. I mean, yeah, they're running the river, but, you know, how much control and skill is going into it?
Yeah, so. Wasn't it Dennis? Aaron and I used to work at this program, UC Davis, called Outdoor Adventures, and Dennis was the coordinator. Didn't Dennis used to say a log can run a class 5 rapid? Does that make a log a class 5 boater? Am I quoting him correctly? Dennis,
I think pretty much. That's my quote, was kind of from Dennis, actually. Yeah,
yeah. Just because you were strapped in a creature craft and you survived Tumwater doesn't make you a class 5 boater, right? You just were strapped in this thing that survived down the river. So I think there's something to be said for, like, doing it with style and precision and being able to run safety for your friends and look out for each other. And, you know, I think that's more of the, like, traditional boating.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, it sounds like you're trash talking the creature crafters a little bit there.
I'm not. I mean, I think it just happens on accident sometimes. Because
I don't think you are either, but I feel like sometimes I think they're a little too sensitive, creature crafters. No, I'm gonna say that.
I just think there's a few that are particularly mouthy that you just get tired of them saying, like, they're super badass when, you know, it's like, I get that you survived that run, but, like, almost anybody can be strapped in that thing and survived it. You know, there's not like there's not something to be bragging about, I think, in telling everybody how rad it is. And I don't know. I like Aaron's. I've boated with him a bit. I think Aaron's a good boater. He's a nice guy to boat with. I like some of the creature crafters. And I like all of them, actually. They're nice people. I just feel like sometimes, in particular, there's a few that maybe, like, talk too much. And it gets annoying. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, sounds good. Yeah. All right.
Well, maybe it's time to move on to our guest. Do you want to be ready to move on to the guest, Aaron?
You bet. Let's do it.
Well, our guest on today's episode is Thor Tingey of Alpaca Packrafts, and welcome to the show, Thor.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people have asked us to have you on as a guest because we've said a lot of things about Packrafts, and neither Priscilla or Eric or I Packraft, and we're kind of ignorant to what they are, what they're about, and there's a lot of questions come to us about them, or people want to have discussions, and I just want to learn more personally about you and packrafting in general, so I just would love to ask some questions. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. And even though I'm kind of like the Packraft guy, being one of the owners of Alpaca and founders and stuff like that, I am not a Packraft evangelist. I actually own more whitewater kayaks than I own Packrafts. So,
wow, that's shocking. That's great to hear. Actually,
yeah,
good, because I'm gonna have questions about whitewater coming down the road. But first, do you want to just tell us how Alpaca got started? Like, what was the idea behind it? How did you guys start the company?
Yeah, certainly. And this kind of, I think, will kind of frame a little bit about the original Packraft intent. So the nutshell story is I went to Colorado College from 96 to 2000, and they had a grant program there for, it was a memorial fund for students to do outdoor trips. And I was a kid that grew up in Alaska in a family with my dad was a rock and ice climber, mountaineer, and my mom was a kayaker, skier. And so I grew up in Alaska doing all these backcountry trips. And we did a couple of summer trips that were usually rafting or canoeing. And then we'd do climbing, or we go ice climbing in the winter kind of thing. And so I really wanted to get one of these grants, and I didn't have any idea what to do. And my parents suggested that I talk to this sort of legendary Alaskan adventurer named Roman Dial. And Roman at that time was maybe one of 10 to 20 people in the world that knew what pack rafting was. So Alpaca did not invent pack rafting. It was around, but it was a very incredibly small number of people doing it. And it was basically just these hardcore Alaskans that were taking these microscopic little rafts so they could travel across the Alaska landscape. Because Alaska is really hard to travel across if you don't have a boat, because the rivers are big, they're fast, they're scary. You really can't cross them on foot. So I meet Roman in a coffee shop in 1997, and he tells me, you got to try pack rafting. And I'm like, well, what's pack rafting? And he's like, oh, well, it's this little backpack weight boat, and you carry it in your backpack, and then when you get to a river, you can either float down it or go across it. And Roman had just completed a 700-mile mountain bike pack raft traverse of the Alaska range that landed him on the cover of National Geographic. Wow. And he said, you know, you got to do this. And he gave me sort of beta on what he thought were the best 175 miles of that route. So me and four college classmates applied for this grant, got a grant, and went up and did 175 mile traverse in the eastern or western Alaska range, down to Lake Clark. And Roman said, well, you need a good boat. And I was like, well, what do I get? And he's like, well, you really need this pack raft called the Sherpa, which was made by Sherpa Snowshoe Company in the 1980s, but only made a few of them because nobody bought them. And I have one, so my buddies have one, but I couldn't loan you it because it's too valuable. And none of my friends would loan you or sell you it. So you're going to have to go down to Walmart or Kmart or something like that and buy this boat called the Sevalor Trail Boat, which was like a 3.5 pound vinyl inflatable that was kind of an army green. And he said, you know, that boat will be inadequate, but you'll survive. You can make that work. So the good thing about being like 19 is that you have a lot of stamina and you don't really I think suffering is a little easier. Mm-hmm. So we set out and we had some epic boat failures. I mean, like 2 or 3 foot long tears in the boats and things like that. But we were able to, you know, patch them with duct tape and MacGyver skills and all this stuff. And we had a super awesome time, even though the boats were kind of a mess and we had hypothermia and all kinds of trials and tribulations with the boats. But the concept stuck, this idea of being able to walk across the Alaska wilderness and then float down rivers to get where you need to go. So 2 years later, I wanted something a little more ambitious. So the same group, plus or minus one person, got together and we planned a our own ground up traverse, where we started in the Central Arctic National Wildlife Refuge on the Canning River and traversed around 700 miles to the village of Kobuk over 40 days. And, you know, for me, that was sort of a life changing experience, this being out in the backcountry, even as a kid that grew up with backcountry and a backcountry family, being out for that long and traveling across that big of a landscape was kind of like, wow, this is really amazing. But we had the same boats. And again, we had the same problems. And in many circumstances, we actually ended up walking sections of river rather than paddling them because the walking was okay. And we didn't want to risk damaging the boats. Mm-hmm. So that's where alpaca comes in. I came back from that trip really liking the concept of pack rafting, but really disappointed with the product that was available. And I think that's how a lot of companies end up starting. Yeah. And I kind of sat there, and my mom was an outdoor clothing designer. She made dog mushing clothing. You know, as a kid, I didn't realize how good I had it. She, you know, made all my ski clothing and stuff. And I thought it was terrible because I had to grow up with homemade clothing instead of, you know, Columbia and Patagonia. I grew up with mom gear. But in reality, I was pretty darn lucky as a kid as far as that goes. But so she was sitting there as an empty nester and said, you know, I really want to try to make a better boat, because she had been a kayaker when she was young. And we got together, and she kind of talked to me about what I wanted out of the boat. And I wanted bigger tubes, and I wanted more durable fabric. But again, the goal at that point was simply a boat that would survive Alaska backcountry, nothing more. And we got together, we built a couple of prototypes in our basement, and this would be in the fall of 2000 in Chugiak, Alaska. And one of those prototypes we still have, it's the first one we ever made, and they were awesome. Suddenly we had more buoyancy, the boats were drier, and they could hold up. And so that's kind of where we started.
And so when you say survive the Alaskan backcountry, were you guys running whitewater rapids in these first trips of the Sevlores? Was it completely flat? Like, what? How difficult was the whitewater? Or was it rocky?
So I would describe it as in a whitewater class rating, I don't recall us ever paddling anything harder than class 2. But Alaska is filled with these high gradient, low volume, rocky, bouncy rivers. So we would do those kinds of things. And, you know, when you hit a rock with a vinyl pool toy, it doesn't end well. So we spent a lot of time kind of swimming and dealing with tears in boats. So we really wanted a boat that could bounce off these rocks and get you down the river. But we weren't envisioning, at the time we started making these, I didn't envision, like, you know, running whitewater in a serious or aesthetic way. I was just like total point A to point B. That was the goal.
And with, when you're doing these trips, were you going from river to river? You weren't like falling one river for like 200 miles, right? You were doing like one for 10 and hiking up over a ridge to a different one. Like, what did the travel look like on those trips?
Exactly. So when you're doing, and that's changed today. Now you're doing a lot more of spending a lot more time on the river, and pack rafting has become a little bit more about, like, more focused on essentially maybe using the backcountry to access a large river system and then float down it for a long time. But at the time, we were traversing essentially the spine of a mountain range. And by essentially walking up one river valley, going down one river valley, crossing over and up another river valley, and just kind of like leapfrogging up and over little divides to get to new watersheds and using those to travel. Because in Alaska, riverways are really your only way to travel easily. It's very hard to just say, we're going to set a course for 300 degrees north and start walking that way.
Okay, so when you start it, so that's fascinating. Like, to me, it's like the idea is you're kind of backpacking with a lightweight boat in your backpack that you can use to do some travel down rivers or just get across rivers in a safer manner. Yep. And so when you started to make the more durable boats, how did you find the fabric? Like, what fabric did you decide to use? That must have been the hard part.
Well, so, yeah, that was a challenge. And our first fabric, we literally went to Seattle Fabrics, which is a large fabric supplier that does have a variety of outdoor textiles. And we were, like, digging around for anything that was urethane coated. And that's where the original prototype boats came from. And we tested a few PVC coated boats. And PVC is heavy and cheap. and not very durable, and urethane is expensive and lightweight and durable. So we knew we wanted urethane, and so we got some sample fabrics, but we didn't know where they came from or anything like that. We used that to make the prototypes. And then our first rafts that we commercially made, we actually had them contract manufactured by Jack's Plastic Welding and Aztec New Mexico, you know, the Paco Pack guys. Yeah. And in the course of communicating with Jack and stuff, I believe we got connected with somebody that had a line on fabric, and we got several hundred yards of this urethane coated material that was a tealy green and had been manufactured for the U.S. military, and it hadn't met their spec for some reason or another, and somebody was looking to offload it. And we bought it, and that's where we started. And then about that got us through the first couple of years. And then in that time, we kind of used that opportunity to go around to various trade shows and eventually got connected to a fabric supplier based in Canada. And we had to do a lot of effort to get them to even talk to us, but eventually we got one of their lead engineers to sort of say, okay, I'll work with you. And they kind of designed our first fabric based on what we wanted, because we're not chemical engineers, so we're like, well, this is what we're using them for, and we want this and we want that. And there's a tremendous number of factors that go into designing a fabric. You know, you don't just, even if you have a fabric supplier, you don't just call up and say, hey, I want this 210 denier nylon coated with urethane. You can do that, but it doesn't necessarily get you the optimal fabric. It'll get you something similar, but it's not the same. And so we're the new supplier now, but we've been with them for a decade. And, you know, so we spend a lot of time, even though if we're not doing the chemical engineering, we're communicating with them to make sure that we're optimizing tear strength versus fabric durability versus the adhesion strength of the urethane onto the nylon. Because if you change one of those things, then you can negatively affect the other. So you kind of, we have a balance that we look for.
So the fabric that you have is made specifically for you guys almost. It's a, right, because you say, hey, we need this fabric for the boats. Can you guys make some tweaks to it? And at this point, it's very specific to what you need.
Yeah, so the finished product is made specifically to us. Like the base nylon would be not specifically made to us necessarily, but we do choose, for example, we have access to several different weavers and sources of nylon. Not all nylon's the same. Like Cordura is a branded form of nylon. Nylon's a generic term. And so we will choose a nylon that kind of fits our needs. So we choose that. And then the urethane itself is made by a separate manufacturer, and then the company that essentially marries those two, that laminates the urethane onto the nylon, they then have inputs in terms of how hot it's done and how much adhesion and how much tear is left in the fabric. And so they're the ones we work with really closely to make it meet our specs.
Wow. Let's go back to when you first made boats, like the first few that you made commercially. When you made them, was there all of a sudden a ton of interest? I mean, I imagine because it was hard to get a boat, did all of a sudden a ton of people come out of the woodwork saying, yes, we need this boat?
You know, partly yes and partly very much no. We've been fortunate to be a fairly slow growing industry. And I say that in a good way. Our first year, we only sold a few boats, and they were definitely to the 15 hardcore Alaskans that were holding onto their 15 year old Sherpa pack rafts at that point. And they kind of came around, oh, here, there's a new pack raft. And they ended up buying boats. And then as people in Alaska kind of found out that there was finally a durable boat that, you know, you're not necessarily always risking life and limb to go to the Alaska backcountry. And we started gaining popularity in Alaska and then in kind of other places throughout the world, New Zealand and Scandinavia and things like that. But it was still very, very slow growth. And I think in the second year we were there, we maybe only made it through the year because they happened to input pack rafting, probably partly because of Roman Dial, into the Eco Challenge. So we ended up selling like 100 pack rafts in August because of Eco Challenge, and we'd sold like 20 the previous 6 months combined.
And what was the idea then to start a business? Like, were you a, was this just like a Were you ever a business person, or you just kind of fell into this?
So that's kind of a funny part of the story, because I myself wasn't ever a business person. I was just the son that wanted a boat so I could do these cool trips.
Yeah.
And my mom, she was the designer, and she had had a custom ski clothing business in Jackson Hole in the 1960s and 70s. So she'd had a business background, and she wanted to get back into it. So she was the one driving the business aspect of things. But those first 4 years, I was around and participating a lot and being involved. I didn't run the day-to-day business at all. And then I left in 2004. I left Alaska and moved to Oregon to go to law school. And at that time, I didn't necessarily see alpaca as a long-term option for me, partly because as a 25-year-old, I wasn't in the mindset that I could probably work with my mother on a day-to-day basis for the rest of my life, which was probably smart at the time, because I had spent 11 years away from the business on a day-to-day level and came back 4 years ago. And now we work together really, really well, but I don't think it would have worked so well if we had done that in the early years.
And is she in Colorado as well?
Yeah, she's still here. Wow. She's 74 years old or 73, and she still works every day, although on a shortened schedule. Fortunately, with my wife and I here running the day-to-day business, she's now a full-time designer, and she just gets to play with new ideas all day. So I think she's having a lot of fun.
So what I want to ask you about now is, like, today in 2019, what are these boats designed to do? I mean, I think I bring this up because I've seen them struggle on harder rivers, and are they, like, designed now for the more Alaska type trip? Are they designed for running whitewater? Is it for everything? Like, what are alpacas made to do now? Like, what's the goal of the boat?
They have evolved over the years, and they've evolved from, in the early years, they were sort of this necessary ultra lightweight boat that could get you from point A to point B, but by and large, you were focusing on walking more than floating.
Yeah.
To the point where now, for about the last 9 years, they've been focused much more on boating rather than walking. Like, now you walk to boat before you boated to get to the next walking section.
That's a good way to put it.
But we've really tried not to lose sort of sight of that original intent. And so far and away, our most popular boat, the Classic, which is what we've been making for 19 years now, it's still centered around that. It's a really easy to paddle, fun, simple design that will get you down a river in comfort and let you have a good time, even if it would fall short of sort of the technical abilities of a more purpose-built craft. But in doing so, I always like to analogize to mountain bikes to some degree, because, you know, in 2005-ish, you know, we had three kinds of mountain bikes. We had these, like, really whippy XC bikes that were terrifying to ride, but, you know, you rode them in the races that were basically fire roads. And then you had, like, downhill bikes that were, like, if you had a chairlift, you could ride those. But then everybody else rode this standard 140-millimeter trail bike, and that's what it was. And then around 2005, 2006, suddenly out comes this 160-millimeter bike that you can pedal up and then really ride harder trails down. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that, then it was like, oh, now that we have this bigger bike, we can make this lighter weight 130-mil trail bike that's a little bit lighter and a little bit better to paddle, and this sort of generalist bike disappeared. And now that's come back, but now we have like 10 different classifications of mountain bikes for different styles of trail.
Yeah, I have friends that have two mountain bikes. That's insane to me. Like, this is my downhill bike. That's my cross country bike. Kind of like skis. You need to have two or three pairs of skis now.
Exactly. So we do have some, like, our most popular boats and our most popular sales far and away are our generalists. And I think they'll be that way for a long time. But we've been able to, as we've grown and had more sales and more money to invest in R&D, we've been able to do more purpose-built boats. And so we have two-person boats now that are really fun and can carry a ton of weight. And then we've kind of invested a lot of R&D into developing more whitewater-specific pack rafts. And I think the key thing there is I think it's easy for a lot of people that are new to pack rafting or don't know much about it that to think that all pack rafts are the same. And our generic boats, they'll handle up to class three whitewater just fine. You can bounce down it. But our whitewater specific boats are a whole different class of craft in terms of what they can do in the hands of an experienced paddler.
So you mind if I hop in here, Zach?
Yeah, please do.
Hey, so I'm curious, Doris. So I don't know. I'm curious first, like what type of paddler you are when you're like hard shell kayaking. Like, what you'll run in that, and will you run this to the same level with your pack wrap? You're like, yeah, I'll drop class five in my pack wrap and my hard shell, or, you know, like where are those lines for you? I guess, like, with the variance with the craft, and
you know, it depends. You have to understand the limitations. So, to put it into perspective, I would call our modern whitewater boats, which have 4-point thigh straps, which make are super secure, a back band, and then internal gear storage. You know, I am pretty comfortable combat rolling them in 99% of situations. Definitely when I'm stuck in a hydraulic, they're a little bit hard to get out of because you don't quite have the edge. And if you're up against a wall, because the boat's wider, it's really hard to get it turned over. But otherwise, I don't swim very often in a pack raft anymore because I can roll out of it. I wouldn't say that's the norm, but I would say that I'm seeing it more and more amongst better paddlers that are jumping into them. But in terms of what they can do, it sort of depends on the situation. So the Grand Canyon is a good example of, you know, class big water, class 3-4. Pack rafts are really fun in the Grand because it's high volume and these are super buoyant, easy to paddle boats, and so they cruise down it. The same thing, they're really, really fun when you get into what I'll call sort of steep, low volume, creaky class 4, and even running harder class 5 runs in the right conditions. So in Southwest Colorado, we've got Vallecito Creek, you know, which is kind of the ultra classic, awesome class 5 test piece around here. And I don't know the foot gauge flows, but basically kayakers start paddling at around 200 CFS. They will paddle it a little bit under that, and then they'll paddle it all the way up to about 350 CFS. That Vallecito Creek is really, really fun in a pack raft between 160 and 200 CFS. And I've got close friends around here that are very, very good paddlers that are paddling at 250 in pack rafts. But at 300, short of maybe one or two of those guys, you know, I would not go into Vallecito at 300 CFS in a pack raft, even though that's a very reasonable flow in a kayak. And it's just because the holes start to get munchier, start to get a little bit stickier. And so you have to be a little more on the ball on the pack raft. There's some things that they do better than a kayak in terms of floating up and over things, but there's some things they do worse in terms of if you've really got to punch through a hole or a really steep slide into a hole, you can get in trouble if you don't know what you're doing right.
Do you think they're better at lower volume than kayaks?
I would hesitate to use the word better. I think they can be more fun in certain ways. And so the example that I give is if you think of your local class 4, maybe trending into easy class 5 boating run, mm-hmm. That you paddle a lot and you really enjoy, you kind of got a flow range that you think that runs great. And then you've got a flow range that maybe is on the low end of that you go in there and you're in a kayak and you're just kind of banging around down through there. It's hard to kind of find much flow and you're hitting rocks and you're kind of like, I don't know if I'm into this. The pack raft, it's actually pretty fun to go in there and carve around stuff, but to bounce off it as well.
So I guess I should phrase my question like, I think what I hear you saying is that, you know, there's runs that where you just don't do a hard shell at low water. You do if you have to, if you're desperate, they go, but they're sometimes not that fun because they're penny or there's some weird stuff. But in a pack raft, you're in this inflatable thing. It's actually pretty fun to like bounce down these normal runs at lower water. More fun than being inside of your kayak kind of mashing into rocks.
Exactly. And they're super fun in that situation. But that being said, people are, as the boats have improved and some honestly, as better paddlers have gotten into them, I'm seeing them run more consistently stuff that's right in the same wheelhouse as kayaks, and running it with some style. You know, we've run Black Canyon, the Gunnison in them. We're walking the biggest drops, but most kayakers are walking those drops as well. So I would really define it as if you're a highly skilled boater, class four can be really, really fun in a pack raft if you know what you're doing. And then class five is limited to specific circumstances.
Okay. So the reason this comes up for me a lot, have you paddled the Chetka River in Southern Oregon?
No, it's been super, super high on my list for a while. Yeah. I just haven't quite caught it.
It's a place that I'm really fond of, and I go there a lot. And my first trip in, we hiked in. It's a hard hike in. And one of the guys had a pack raft, and he struggled a little bit, but he's really good at pack rafting, and he made it. And that was my first experience seeing pack rafters. And I went to go run that trip commercially. I got a commercial permit to run it. And so mm-hmm. I built this boat for Sotar based, and it was inspired by the alpaca, but I just wanted a longer alpaca, right? Like,
yep.
I wanted it to be like 10 feet so we could put dry bags in it and carry more gear and not just be, you know, constrained to what you could put in your lap, more or less. And I know that's not always the case, but like back then it was like he had an alpaca with a dry bag on his lap, and it was tough for him compared to having overnight gear shoved in our kayaks. But then in inflatable, yep. I love tying stuff in. So I love this. I love the big – what I loved about the alpaca was the big bulbous nose, like all the volume in the bow and the stern that could plow through things. So I just took the idea of an alpaca or a pack raft and just stretched yep. it out to 10 feet and said, Sotar, make this boat. But don't like – just make it constant diameter. Don't do the fancy bow and stern. And that's yep. the boat I've been using for a long time, and I love it. Like, I think it works really well with a lot of gear. And people always tell me, like, why don't you use pack rafts? And my response to them is, we just can't carry as much gear in the pack rafts to do a, you know, 5-day trip. What do you think about that? Do you think we could? Because it sounds like, and one of the issues I think too is like on this Chetka River, it's shallow. So
yep.
we're hitting our butts on rocks a lot, which in a regular inflatable kayak isn't a big deal. But the pack rafts I've seen, it's hard because the floors are really thin.
Like, yeah, the floor should still hold up to that. So, you know, a couple of thoughts at that. One is the boat you probably experienced was a much older model. It certainly didn't have a cargo fly zipper. And that zipper is a airtight T-zip zipper that allows you to store your gear in the boat. You know,
I've heard about this. Let's talk about this separately because that's yeah. interesting to me. But I have some issues with that separately.
Yeah.
I was going to step in here too, just Thor, and just say, like, I've used the T-zip, that style, on a pack raft, and we had like 14 days worth of food on a cold trip with all our gear. We were really comfortable. Like,
yeah,
a bunch of
that system was the biggest, you know, in addition to the pointier stern that sort of stabilized the boat, that system was the biggest leap forward in terms of making the boats from, as I go back to this idea of a boat to get you to the next walking section, to finally to a boat that can actually handle multi days on its own. And that's really the big difference, because yeah, we're doing self-support Grand Canyon trips where we're taking 12 days. And in this last trip, I took two regular full size down pillows with me, a Yeti cooler, and
in a pack raft,
inside the tubes of a pack raft.
That doesn't make any sense to me. There's not that much volume. How'd you get a Yeti cooler in there?
The soft one.
They're pretty big.
Yeah, the stern of a modern pack raft is huge.
Okay.
So that's the thing. Is like the new boats are just a totally different paradigm in terms of what they can do. And so suddenly, you know, you're going from this kind of like thing that you're bobbing down to suddenly you're in a boat where your gear is evenly weighted. It's below the center of gravity's low, you're locked in there with thigh straps, and you can fully like put that boat on edge and carve into eddies and like do kayak like things with it.
Huh. Is that why the stern is so big? Is it for volume for gear or a different?
What's reason? That?
Is the stern so big because you say for like you said, there's so much room in the stern. Is that why you've chosen the stern to be so big, or are there other reasons?
It was partly that, and partly extra volume in the stern makes the boat sit a little more trim on the water, and it pushes through holes and waves so much better. Old school pack rafts with a little stubby sterns, we call them stubbies. You know, you drop into a hole and you just get back ender.
Yeah.
And the new ones, you just like rocket through.
So, you mind if I?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I was curious, the pack rafts handle better when they've got weight in them than when they don't?
Yeah. What I tell people is that every bit of weight you add up to about 30 pounds inside will actually improve handling because it stabilizes the boat and makes it respond a little bit better. And then from 30 to about 60 or 70 pounds inside the boat will still handle really well, but you'll notice a slight reduction in handling, just like when you add more weight into a kayak. So I wouldn't go run really technical hard class four with 50 pounds in the boat because it becomes a little more sluggish and you just feel behind the eight ball all the time. And then above 70 pounds in the boat, it's noticeably sluggish. It's great on the Grand Canyon where you're just punching over huge waves, but I wouldn't go run smaller rivers with that. But you know,
so when you're
go for it.
When you're running those rivers in Colorado, then like the ones near your hometown, do you bring weight just to put weight in it to make it run better? You're like, yeah, I'll bring, you know, whatever, bring some beers for the end of the day and put them in your tubes just to put a little weight in there, or do you just go without then in those cases?
It sort of depends. Sometimes I will bring a little bit of weight and just throw it in there, or like I'll bring my whole change of clothes and all that stuff just so I have 10 or 15 pounds in the tubes and just kind of handles just a titch better.
Oh, cool. Nice. Thanks.
This is blow my mind a little bit.
Real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like the Checo, you know, that's a real good example. And I haven't been on it, but I know some of my best friends have done it many times and they love it. And the first time that they went in there, you know, they went in at like 600 CFS and bounced down it and said it was super fun. And then as we've come out with more and more boats or higher performance boats, you know, they're now telling me that they won't go in unless it's 1800. So that just kind of gets you the idea of like, oh, there's a little more performance coming out of these boats. And so guys are now going in and wanting some of that flow to be able to run cleanly.
So for me, I'm doing it down to like 400.
Yeah.
Because I have commercial guests with me and we don't want to go too fast. Like if the river's up, they're not able to catch eddies and there's holes they have to punch through. They don't know how to do. Like almost anybody who's athletic, I can get them down the Chetco in an inflatable kayak. They just have to be able to be somewhat athletic. At high water, they have to have boating skills too. And it's a little bit more nerve wracking if they swim.
Absolutely.
So I'm thinking about low, low water even. And I'll talk about that in a second. But first I want to ask about the zippers before I forget. If the boat pops, this is my issue. If you pop the boat, what happens to your down pillow?
Oh, in that case, my down pillow would be wet.
Okay.
But I can say myself personally that I've only had one major tear, like a tear more than an inch long in my entire life of paddling post-alpaca.
Wow. They're
pretty darn durable. I'm also a better paddler now, so I avoid ramming it into the, like really bad things.
So I've seen one tear. I've used them a couple times. I've seen them used a couple times, and of those couple times, I've seen one tear. So I'm hypersensitive to them tearing.
Yep.
And maybe I shouldn't be.
Your regular stuff on our whitewater boats, and you can buy them for the regular boats. They do come with two internal dry bags. So while my down pillow would have gotten wet, all of my overnight gear and stuff like that is in separate dry bags inside the tubes.
And is it true there's just one chamber, like in
there
the boat?
There is just one chamber. Okay. Yep.
So if you're in the Grand Canyon and you tore a boat, it would sink.
It would not sink, especially when you have those internal dry bags because they themselves are flotation chambers.
Okay.
When I popped the one really bad, it was on the Piedra here in Colorado, which is a class 4+ run. And I just sliced it on a rock carving into an eddy in the middle of the river. And it was challenging to get that boat to shore, but I swam it to shore without a whole lot of effort. It was definitely easier than getting any full kayak to shore.
So I want to go back. Cool, cool. Now we're going to the Chetco. So because I'm constantly like shaving ounces and pounds off of our gear to make the hike in better and better. And I would love to go to like an alpaca because it's so light.
Yeah.
But for us, like for stability, I've noticed with commercial guests, we need a longer boat. When the boat's shorter, it just isn't as stable. I worry that people will struggle. And I noticed you guys have that new, you mentioned earlier, that two-person boat, that gear hauler.
The Forager.
The Forager. Is that that boat? That could that be the boat that we use for the Chetco that we put people in put and keep them stable?
Yeah, seeing the boat, seeing the boats that you've used over the years, you know, that's going to be a closer boat to it. A Forager is going to be still quite a bit wider and more buoyant than a typical IK. Mm-hmm. You know,
the ones we use are pretty big.
You know, I won't badmouth IKs at all. I mean, they're cool boats and they do a lot of things for people. And I don't think a pack raft is better or more stable or easier to paddle than an IK. I think it's different and works better for different situations.
Yeah.
You know, it's a dramatically better backpacking boat, which is what it's designed for.
Yeah.
And on the opposite end of the spectrum, I'll say that if you really do want to run hard whitewater and you know what you're doing, like I wouldn't recommend people just, you know, buy a pack raft to go run class four. They should buy a kayak and then learn it that way and then come back to the pack raft to run class four or five. But if you want to start, you know, test piecing more difficult whitewater, I think the modern whitewater pack rafts will outperform an IK because they have more of a defined edge there and you can put them on that edge and carve them much better. They boof, they do normal kayak things, albeit a little bit slower with a few limitations.
Are they self-bailing?
We do make self-bailing models, including in our whitewater series. I myself paddle with the decked version, mostly because I don't like punching holes and having my boat filled with water and having that short interval where I've got a heavy boat that doesn't maneuver as quickly and I can roll well. So I don't ever worry about flipping back upside.
So going back to this Chetco idea, like, is it possible to make the boat that I have, like you've probably seen photos of it, this like big long thing out of that material? Like, would there be an issue with making a boat that long out of that material?
You know, when you push into that length, you do have some compromises because, you know, in a traditional IK, you're running a much heavier duty material, which itself becomes more rigid as you put air pressure into it compared to ours. But I just speculating here, my guess is that if I sent you a modern pack raft with its rigging and its setup, that you would go down there and go, oh, this would work great for the Chetco. I'm not going to say like, you're going to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to get rid of all my IKs because this pack raft is so much better. I don't know that that's true, but you probably wouldn't have the same opinion of a pack raft as you do based on the one you've been in.
Now, I think I would enjoy paddling it, but would commercial guests that we have enjoy paddling it? Would they feel comfortable in it? That's the question I have.
Yeah, they would. And we have a number of, you know, guide services that are now using them for exactly that kind of purposes. Not the Chetco, but they're doing stuff in Alaska and they're doing stuff in Montana. And we've got some great ones over in Europe that are doing these kind of things. And they're really able to do some cool things with their clients. I also know, I can't remember her name. My wife, Sarah, has recently been working with her, but we got a call out of the blue from a woman who runs the California Women's Whitewater Collective. And, you know, they do kayak instruction for women and they spend a lot of time with women in IKs in addition to regular kayaks. And she called us because she'd never seen a pack raft before and she had a customer show up who had asked for some private lessons and she brought along a pack raft with her. And it happened to be one of the whitewater models. And she got in it and paddled it around and was like, wow, it's light. It does so many things that I want to be able to teach these women to be able to do so they can transition into hard shell kayaking that I'm struggling to do in an IK. And as she described it, you know, when you're in a big IK, if you go peeling out of an eddy and you do it wrong, generally nothing happens.
Uh-huh.
And we definitely have boats like that. But we also have higher performance boats that when you go peeling out of the eddy, and you do something wrong, it's not like a kayak. You don't get whiplash getting folded upstream, but you're kind of like, oh, I feel that.
Huh. Yeah. I'm excited to try one out. I'm going to go look at your website and look at them and maybe get one, just because I'm always trying to innovate for our Chetco trips. And I need to, now that I've talked to you, my mind is spinning.
So for your Chetco trips, the boats that I would recommend that you look at for yourself, I would recommend looking at either the Wolverine, which is a lower volume, little higher performance whitewater boat, or the Narwhal, which is the high volume, carries more weight boat. And then I'd recommend for, like, if you're thinking along the lines of clients, look at the Mule in a self-bailing format.
Okay. I'm always thinking about the clients. I can paddle anything. I'm always thinking about the best, safest boat for our clients, but on the water, but also weight in terms of hiking that thing in.
For the Chetco, a self-bailing Mule with a cargo fly.
Okay. So I'm Googling it right now. Mule, alpaca. I'm going to look it up. And we're definitely going beyond our time limit for the episode, so like we probably have to finish it up here pretty quick, but I think I'll have to paddle one and get you back on and have a follow-up talk about this.
Yeah,
really fun talk. And I know Eric and Priscilla want to chat with you, but Aaron, do you have any questions you want to ask still?
I guess one last one. I was curious, do you guys have anything like designed for more like long lake crossings, more of a sea kayak style, like to make miles across flat water, you know, because we've been talking whitewater, and I'm all about running the whitewater, but, you know, there's some trips I've been looking into where it's a lot of flat water and you want to be able to make miles. And I was wondering if you have anything of that nature.
I should say no comment, but I'm going to laugh. So, you know, we've been testing a lot of prototypes around that concept for a number of years. With great success, some with less success. And, you know, there's always a factor. You know, just because you can make something doesn't mean you can make it for a price that you could sell it at, kind of thing. But that's definitely something that's on our radar. We have a new boat this year called the Oryx, which is a two-person canoe-style boat. So you sit upright like you would a traditional canoe. And I literally, on Saturday night, got back from a two-day trip in the Boundary Waters, kind of playing around with that boat. And it's fantastic for what it is, but it's still a pack raft. It's still slow on a long lake crossing. It'll do the job better than our single boats, but, you know, I would be reluctant to tell somebody, oh yeah, you're just going to love paddling 20 miles of flat water on a lake with this. It's more of a mix of lakes and then easier downriver stuff. It's great for that, but it's definitely something that we keep looking at.
Cool. I think.
Well, yeah, I want to finish up. We end every episode with what we call Gear of the Week. And so if you have a Gear of the Week, Thor, you want to just like shout out to, just as a finish up, I'll start. My Gear of the Week is the Astral Blue Jacket. I've just been digging that PFD. It's a great PFD. I highly recommend it to everybody. A lot of people like to have safety harnesses, and I think that they're not for everybody. And so if you want a good, comfortable PFD without a safety harness, the Astral Blue Jacket's the way to go. So, Aaron, Thor, do either of you guys have Gear of the Week?
You bet. Yeah. On the other extreme, going from those to the MTI Atlas, it's a high flotation vest. We were talking earlier about how, you know, big water out in California right now, and a couple of our guys got them, the Atlas with the 26 founders, and one of them, she was swimming with a bunch of guests, and I mean, she was like halfway out of the water. She was like having conversations as she floated by through the waves. It was amazing. She's like, yeah, I love this. I mean, I can see, and my head's out of the water most of the time. So, been a big fan of that Atlas.
I mean, on that note, Aaron, I know you and I have talked about flotation a lot. I was kayaking the other day with a friend who swam, and he had the Astral Green Vest, which is about the same flotation as the Blue Vest. And I was behind him, and his head was not above water very much. And he was, he's an in-shape guy, you know, shouldn't have a problem. He was out of breath when he pulled over to shore, just kind of like with a little worried look on his face. Like, wow, that was hard. And he mentioned afterwards, like, wow, I'm shocked how much I didn't float in my swim. So
yeah, it's I have a green jacket, and I love it. But even like Astral told me, there's not much more flotation than there is even than their V8, which is just their little tiny one that we sell for pack rafting.
Yeah, I actually did, though. I think the V8, I have the one, the YTV is my...
I love that vest.
it's really comfy. It's minimal. It's great for backpacking in because it's super light. Yep. And I looked at their website. The green jacket has 16 pounds, 4 ounces of flotation. The YTV has 16 pounds, 5 ounces of flotation. So it shockingly has more flotation than the green jacket.
Yep, exactly. Now, the YTV is my backcountry whitewater vest.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so light for carrying in. So, I mean, that's a good point. Flotation is really nice if you swim.
Yep. No, it is for sure. For sure, for sure. But I do have a gear thing. I haven't spent enough time with it, but it's worth considering. The Werner rep stopped by here about 2 weeks ago, and he brought out their new offset paddles. What are they? The Surge and something else that have the offset blades. And I spent a day at the Whitewater Park with him. I want to spend more time with those paddles. There's, you know, feathering and bracing and things like that, especially when you're surfing, that it will take some getting used to. But they are onto something when it comes to straight forward power.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, they're people are hyped up about them, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Thor, thanks for joining us this week. I appreciate your time. Aaron, thanks for taking time to – Aaron's in Hawaii right now. Thanks for taking time to call from Hawaii. And, yeah, look forward to talking to you guys more about this on a future episode.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Thor. Gonna float me into a new state.